Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, March 29th, 2024. I'm your reader, Grace Barter. Federal and City of Cedar Rapids officials celebrated the completion of a floodgate at 12th Avenue Southeast as a milestone in efforts to fortify the city against rising Cedar River waters as part of its approximately $750 million permanent flood protection system. The $6.39 million project, supported by federal funding from the Army Corps of Engineers, was finished last fall and will help shield the historically flood-prone New Bohemia District. The gate can close and lock into place in about 1 hour. It is 8 feet tall, 79 feet long, and weighs roughly 70,000 pounds. With the floodgate completion, the nearly 40,000 linear feet of overall permanent flood protection is about one-third complete. Another 15.6% is under construction, according to Rob Davis, the city's flood control program manager. The east side of Cedar Rapids' flood control system is 43.7% complete, with another 22.6% of the 22,311 linear feet of protection under active construction, he said. Work is slated to wrap up on the east side by the end of 2026. The main east segments that remain, Davis said, are north of Cedar Lake to Interstate 380, through Cedar Lake, Tree of Five Seasons to Quaker Oats, Crandick Railroad Gate and Lot 44 Wall, Quaker Oats to Cedar Lake, First Avenue to 8th Avenue Southeast, Cargill to Otis Road Southeast. The west side stretches 17,259 linear feet and is 19.7% complete, with 6.5% under construction, Davis said. This side is not eligible for Army Corps funding under its cost-benefit formula, which determined the cost of construction on the west side would exceed the value of the buildings it would protect, leaving the city to find other sources of funding. While the 12th Avenue Bridge was closed for construction of the floodgate, crews performed maintenance on the bridge and worked on several nearby projects, O'Donnell said. That includes a new mini roundabout at 12th Avenue and 2nd Street Southeast, and a new city-owned parking lot behind the African American Museum of Iowa. Work on the project prompted the museum to close for a year and undergo $5 million in renovations, including relocating the entrance, since the new floodgate blocked the original entrance. A key segment of the city's permanent flood control system still awaiting federal funds is replacing the 8th Avenue Bridge with a new one, elevated, connecting both sides of the river during floods. Cedar Rapids officials have been lobbying for years to secure federal funding. The new elevated bridge would limit the need to evacuate areas behind the completed flood control system, improve trail access, and expand connectivity across the river. It would be a single-pier cable-stayed bridge designed for a 100-year lifespan. It would have a single pier in the river instead of the current 7 piers to improve the flow of the river and reduce upstream water levels. As the city continues lobbying for the project, estimated at $76.1 million, a new bridge remains several years out. Recently, the City of Cedar Rapids again applied for a $25 million federal RAISE grant, the maximum amount for the 8th Avenue Bridge, through the U.S. Department of Transportation. It also is seeking a $60.9 million Bridge Investment Program grant and a DOT Protect grant. So far, the project is partially funded through general obligation bonds and Iowa Flood Mitigation Program funds. In April 2021, the Iowa Department of Transportation awarded $1 million toward the bridge replacement through its City Bridge program. Four previous grant applications from 2020 through 2023 scored in the top category, highly recommend, but the program is extremely competitive. Only 10 to 15% of applications are awarded funds, according to the city. A Coralville man who drowned in 2022 while rescuing his friend's 8-year-old son from the Iowa River has posthumously been awarded a Carnegie Medal for Heroism by the Carnegie Hero Fund Commission. The commission awards the medal to individuals from throughout the United States and Canada who risk themselves to an extraordinary degree, saving or attempting to save the lives of others. The Carnegie Medal is considered North America's highest civilian honor for heroism, according to a news release about the award. Wegawayu Zahula Ferris died August 5th, 2022, at the age of 42. He was fishing with his family and some friends in the Iowa River at River Junction Access near Lone Tree when Matthias Kassa, the 8-year-old son of Ferris's friend Wandewosen Kendo, went into the river and began struggling. Ferris entered the river to try to save the child. Kendo also got in the water, but struggled to reach Kassa because of the strong current. Ferris got to where Kassa was in the river and began yelling for help, drawing the attention of a nearby kayaker who helped to get the boy safely out of the water, where bystanders performed CPR. Ferris became submerged while helping the boy. After getting the child to shore, the kayaker and others began looking for him as law enforcement was called. Johnson County Sheriff's deputies located Ferris's body about an hour after he went into the water. The child was treated at the University of Iowa hospitals and clinics and released the next day. Kendo has kept in contact with Ferris's family and tries to support them with things that Ferris would have done if he still were alive, including buying Christmas presents for Ferris's children. Ferris was born on May 5, 1980, in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, to Sahila Ferris and Mulu Tuloso, and immigrated to Iowa in 2004, eventually settling in Coralville, according to his obituary. He worked as a custodial worker at City High School in Iowa City for 17 years, while also studying several subjects at Kirkwood Community College, including truck driving classes. Ferris had wanted to start his own truck driving company with Kendo and encouraged Kendo to get his commercial driver's license. Ferris is the first person from Coralville to receive the Carnegie Medal, according to Carnegie Hero Online Records. The Carnegie Hero Fund Commission was made aware of his act of heroism through multiple news articles about the event and a GoFundMe page that was posted on behalf of the family, according to Jules Ferner, the Director of Outreach and Communications for the Carnegie Hero Fund Commission. The GoFundMe page raised $73,371, including a $200 donation from the West High School custodial staff. Recipients of the award or their families receive a base financial grant of $5,500. They also can apply for need-based grants for things such as funeral costs, scholarship opportunities for children of the recipient, and ongoing assistance to families that have lost their main breadwinner. The application process for additional grants for the recently announced winners has not yet been completed, according to Freiner. The awards are announced 4 times a year, and Ferris is one of 17 people to receive the award this quarter. Because each medal is personalized for the individual, it can take 2 or 3 months after the announcement of the award before the medal is made and presented. If the family is interested in a presentation ceremony, the commission will look for a local official who could make the presentation once the medal is ready, Frainer said. Individuals experiencing homelessness in the Cedar Rapids area may more quickly receive vouchers to help them pay for housing costs under a rule change implemented this week by the city, allowing low-income families to better access support by reducing lengthy waits for assistance. The Cedar Rapids City Council approved a rule change Tuesday, enabling the city, which serves as the public housing authority for Linn and Benton counties, to allocate 55 vouchers per year to individuals experiencing homelessness, youths who have aged out of foster care, and to refugee households based on referrals from social service agencies. That rule change took effect immediately upon adoption. Those in most need can get help first. Under the changes, the city will earmark 30 vouchers per year for individuals experiencing homelessness who are referred through the coordinated entry system. Waypoint Services oversees that system, where its staff removes the administrative burden of navigating housing services by completing intakes and making referrals to other local agencies with the goal of helping people secure stable housing. In fiscal 2023, the budget year that ended June 30th, 2023, Waypoint reported serving 13,790 people through that system. Another 15 vouchers per year would be dedicated to youths who have aged out of the foster care system based on referrals from Foundation to Crisis Services and the Iowa Department of Health and Human Services. There would be 10 vouchers per year set aside for refugee households who have fully used their resettlement assistance based on a referral through the state. Instead of people waiting sometimes for years to get on a waiting list for a voucher, Housing Services Manager Sarah Buck said the change allows the city to take applications as the budget allows and push people with the highest needs to the top of the list. The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development allocated the city 1,265 Housing Choice vouchers for fiscal 2024. The vouchers cover 70% of the rent. Buck said per year in Cedar Rapids, 22% of Section 8 households are people age 62 and over, 53% have a head of household member with a disability, 66% of households have an annual income under $15,000. On average, families spend about 8 years on Section 8. For the first time in about 50 years, Buck said HUD is updating how household income is calculated as part of regulatory changes made through the Housing Opportunity Through Modernization Act. It was signed into law in 2016 and makes changes to rules governing HUD's rental assistance programs, including Section 8, as well as public housing. In that process of making administrative plan changes, the city made these discretionary changes to update waiting list preferences for voucher program participants. While the waiting list preferences took effect immediately, other regulatory changes will take effect July 1st at the start of the 2025 state fiscal year. This change emerged from discussions with Washington, D.C.-based National Alliance to End Homelessness, which the city enlisted last year to guide efforts to improve systems supporting the unhoused population and streamline social service efforts. Currently, To get on the waiting list for a voucher, the city takes applications and closes the list sometimes for 3 or more years. Buck said, so individuals couldn't get on the list during that time. The city generally receives 1,300 applications for housing assistance. These preferences adopted Tuesday allow people to get on the waiting list and take priority. Iowa bars, taprooms, and restaurants that serve alcohol would face greater civil liability and insurance requirements if they also sell hemp-derived beverages under a proposed bill that advanced this week out of a Senate subcommittee. Senate Study Bill 3195 would expand the state's dram shop laws, which impose civil liability for selling alcohol to a visibly intoxicated or underage person to apply to consumable hemp products. Dram shop insurance covers liabilities associated with the sale of alcohol, specifically for overservice resulting in intoxication. The law allows people who were victims of someone's drunken behavior to file a lawsuit against bar owners and their employees if a patron is overserved and kills or injures others in crashes or other mishaps after leaving the bar. The bill would expand the applicability of Iowa's Dram Shop Act to include bars, restaurants, and other establishments licensed to serve alcohol that also serve THC drinks or edibles. Current law caps non-economic damages for pain and suffering awarded to a person injured by an intoxicated person who is overserved at $250,000, unless a jury determines there is a substantial or permanent loss or impairment of a bodily function, substantial disfigurement, or death. Economic damages, such as compensation for lost wages or medical expenses, are uncapped. The bill would increase the cap to $500,000 for those that serve consumable hemp products, such as a hemp-based THC seltzer, to an intoxicated person who is overserved and hurts someone after leaving the establishment. Senator Dan Dawson, a Republican from Council Bluffs who chaired the subcommittee, said he is concerned about how combining alcohol and THC-infused drinks can have a different effect on drinkers than those who consume just alcohol. Sometimes called crossfading, the mixing of the two intoxicants can intensify the effects of both. It seems appropriate that the establishments that are selling these types of products have a higher liability than the normal alcohol establishment out there, because they are selling a product that we don't have a whole lot of information on at this point in time right now, Dawson said. This is a different product. There's a delayed reaction there. This works differently compared to alcohol, so that the retailers have to have some liability on this if they're going to sell these. Big Grove Brewery, Iowa's top craft beer brand by sales, purchased a majority share in Climbing Kites, Iowa's first cannabis-infused sparkling water. The brand, currently available at Big Grove Brewery, taprooms, and other retail locations in Iowa, gives consumers a new way to get a buzz without alcohol, thanks to its federally legal THC derived from hemp. The drink was launched in 2024 by Des Moines' Lua Brewing Team and co-founder Scott Selix. Eric Goranson, a lobbyist representing the Iowa Restaurant Association, which was founded the same year Prohibition ended initially to address the new dram shop liabilities, raised concerns over how establishments would provide training to detect if someone is intoxicated on THC, as well as the impact of the legislation on insurance premiums for Iowa bars, restaurants, taverns, and the like. Senator Bill Dotzler, a Democrat from Waterloo, who served on the subcommittee, said he had mixed emotions about the proposed bill, citing potential impact on bar business from increased insurance rates and concerns about mixing THC and alcohol. Dotzler said he's tried a hemp-based THC drink and noted his family ran a bar for 40 years. I didn't even know a thing about it until the last bill, Dotzler said of separate legislation to limit the potency of hemp-derived cannabis products sold in Iowa. So I went, got one, and saw how it worked. I was surprised, but I wasn't hammered, so to speak. Dotzler noted the drink had a delayed effect that can create an opportunity to consume more before it all hits you. Hemp, legalized federally in 2018 by the passage of the Farm Bill, opened the door to commercial production of hemp-based products. Most drinks on shelves today offer THC in doses of 5 to 10 milligrams. While hemp is limited by its THC concentration, there is no limit on the number of milligrams an individual product can be made with. House File 2605, which passed out of the House and is pending in the Senate, would set a limit of 4 milligrams of THC per serving and 10 milligrams per package on consumable hemp products sold in the state. Teresa Harms, a lobbyist with Consumable Hemp Advocates, urged lawmakers to clarify definitions of consumable hemp products to address intoxicating versus non-intoxicating products that include non-psychoactive CBD and low amounts of THC, the main chemical in marijuana that causes the high. Harms said several states have restricted or banned products over 10 milligrams per serving, and that the World Health Organization, National Institutes of Health, and other organizations recognize there is some therapeutic value in low-potency CBD products. Leslie Carpenter with the Iowa Mental Health Advocacy said the group supports the bill. She said in other states where high-potency THC drinks are legal, there have been increased incidents of impaired driving and car crashes, and people going into psychosis, people developing schizophrenia, even when they don't have a family history of mental illness in their family. Dawson said he intends to amend the bill, but still was having conversations as to what that would entail. The bill now goes to the Senate Ways and Means Committee. A Delaware County jury has ordered the City of Manchester to pay $4.25 million to the parents of Augustine Gus Mormon in the wrongful death lawsuit they brought against the city and a police officer, finding the officer responsible for their son's death. The jury reached a verdict March 22nd, finding James Wessels, now a lieutenant with the Manchester Police Department, had committed assault and battery and wasn't justified in his actions when he chose to pursue a high-speed chase of Mormon's motorcycle on December 10th, 2020, according to court documents. The jury also awarded Wessels to pay $10,000 in punitive damages to parents Dan and Sandy Mormon of Colesburg. Messages seeking comment from Manchester City leaders were not immediately returned Thursday afternoon. According to the lawsuit and police reports, other officers ended the pursuit for safety reasons, but Wessels continued and then struck Mormon's motorcycle. Wessels' police vehicle came into contact twice on opposite sides with the motorcycle, according to the lawsuit. The lawsuit asserted that led to the inescapable conclusion that Wessels caused the crash and intentionally killed Mormon. Mormon, 31, was seriously injured and died about a month later from his injuries on January 15, 2021. An autopsy stated the cause of death of cervical trauma, spinal cord injuries. O'Brien said Mormon's parents filed the lawsuit when they couldn't get answers from the Manchester Police Department about the crash. Both parents said they don't excuse their son's wrongful and reckless behavior in speeding and refusing to stop. They say he should have been convicted of his criminal conduct, but he did not deserve to be executed. A fertilizer spill this month in southwest Iowa killed all the fish in a 60-mile stretch of river with an estimated death toll of more than 750,000, according to Iowa and Missouri conservation officers. That is the biggest fish kill in Iowa in at least a decade and the fifth largest on record, according to state data. And it could have been worse. Fish populations likely were smaller than normal when the spill happened because of cold water temperatures and low river flows. The spill originated at New Cooperative in Red Oak, where a valve that either malfunctioned or was not properly closed leaked about 265,000 gallons of liquid nitrogen fertilizer, most of which went into the nearby East Nishnabotna River. The leak happened on a weekend from March 9th to 11th in an area where the fertilizer is distributed to customers of the farmers' co-op. That area is not required by state rules to have barriers that would prevent a leak from reaching the river. The result was a widespread annihilation of aquatic life. A state investigation found dead or dying fish for 50 miles of river, beyond where the East and West Nishnabotnas meet, all the way to the Missouri border. There also were numerous dead frogs, snakes, mussels, and earthworms. The Iowa DNR will return in late spring to note whether the fertilizer killed turtles that had buried themselves in the river bottom for winter. Their bloated carcasses will float to the river surface. Todd Meyer of Shenandoah planned to fish the East Nishnabotna not long after hearing about the spill. River contaminations have happened in the area, but never impeded his boating trips on the east or west segments of the river. For example, about a week after the fertilizer spill, gasoline overflowed from an underground tank at an Atlantic convenience store, and some of it went into the East Nishnabotna. That did not result in an apparent fish kill, the Iowa DNR said. But after the fertilizer spill, the whole river was full of dead fish, Meyer recalled. It was just nuts. Meyer used a drone to survey the dead fish in the East Nishnabotna River a few days after the spill. The carnage continued into Missouri, where the unified Nishnabotna River flows for about 10 miles before it meets the Missouri River. Matt Combs, a science unit supervisor for the Missouri Department of Conservation, said there was a near total fish kill in that state. The department surveyed one bank of the river for about 2 miles and counted nearly 4,000 dead fish. It will use that sample to estimate the total number of fish that were killed, Combs said, which will likely be in the tens of thousands. The department is continuing to monitor the Missouri and Nishnabotna rivers for additional effects from the contamination. It's possible New Cooperative will face sanctions in both states. The size of the fish kill in Iowa was estimated to be about 749,000, said Chris Larson, a fisheries supervisor for the Iowa DNR. Small fish, such as minnows and chubs, account for the vast majority of those fish, but among them were also about 7,700 channel catfish that anglers target. Those who are responsible for fish kills typically pay restitution to the state based on the number and types of fish that die. Larson said a total restitution amount has not been solidified, but that the estimated value of the small fish is about $85,000. The value of the catfish would be about $115,000. Those two figures combined would be the largest valuation for a documented Iowa fish kill, according to Iowa DNR data. Others that have caused recent fish kills have typically paid fish restitutions and fines up to $10,000, the maximum the agency can order administratively. The department has the option to seek higher penalties in district court. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, March 29, 2024, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now we have some continued news from the Capitol Notebook. The Iowa State law enforcement officers and National Guard troops are being sent to the U.S.-Mexico border in Texas to assist authorities there with immigration enforcement, Governor Kim Reynolds' office announced. 8 Iowa State Patrol troopers and 2 sergeants from the Iowa Department of Public Safety will deploy Sunday for 28 days. The Iowa National Guard will conduct 2 missions in Texas. 110 Guard members will support the Texas Military Department's security objectives, deploying April 1st until May 3rd. Another 5 Guard members will provide ground vehicle maintenance and public affairs support, deploying April 1st through September 30th. It will be the 3rd time Reynolds has deployed Iowans to assist Texas authorities with border security. In 2021, she dispatched 30 Iowa State Patrol officers. Last year, Reynolds sent 31 Iowa State Patrol officers and 109 Iowa National Guard troops for separate one-month employments. As with in previous deployments of Iowa personnel, according to the governor's office, all costs related to the latest deployments will be covered by federal pandemic relief funding from the American Rescue Plan that President Joe Biden signed into law in 2021 and Reynolds opposed. Last year's deployment cost $2 million, according to the governor's office. Iowa House lawmakers are looking to update the disability compensation rules for police and firefighters to fix what they see as a flaw in state law. House Study Bill 745, which passed out of the House Ways and Means Committee on Thursday, would extend disability coverage for Iowa's police and firefighters to include disabilities caused by long-term physical stress and mental health conditions. The bill changes the state's pension program for professional police and firefighters, which covers police departments in 49 of Iowa's larger cities and fire departments in 38 of those. A past Iowa Supreme Court ruling found that state law currently allows police and firefighters to receive disability benefits only if their disability can be traced to a specific incident, said the committee's chair, Representative Bobby Kaufman, Republican from Wilton. Disabilities that appear after decades on the job caused by work duties like carrying heavy equipment are not covered. The bill would specify that any disability that was caused by the employment is covered, regardless of it being linked to a specific incident. The bill also would add disability coverage for mental health conditions caused by traumatic incidents on the job, including post-traumatic stress disorder. Unlike the physical disabilities, the condition would need to be traceable to a specific traumatic incident or incidents to be covered. Firefighters and police supported the bill during the subcommittee hearing, saying the long-awaited proposal was necessary to ensure that Iowa's police officers receive the same coverage as those in the private sector. Brandon Flansner, the Secretary-Treasurer of Iowa Professional Firefighters, said that coverage for PTSD was a growing need for firefighters. Bill would raise costs for cities, which would need to offer more disability coverage through insurance. The Iowa League of Cities, which represents hundreds of cities in the state, is registered against the bill. The Metro Coalition, representing the state's 10 largest cities, is undecided. Iowa League of Cities lobbyist Daniel Stalder said Smaller cities with shrinking populations would have trouble keeping up with the cost increases in the bill. The bill passed unanimously out of the committee Thursday. It comes as House lawmakers continue to pursue legislation expanding the disability coverage for firefighters who develop cancer on the job. House File 2482, which the chamber passed in February, would have covered all cancers under a firefighter's disability benefits, rather than the specific list that is currently covered. The Senate did not take up the bill before a legislative funnel deadline last month. Senator Jason Schultz, the chair of the Senate State Government Committee, said he did not have enough time to research the cost impacts of the bill before the deadline. Schultz said he doesn't expect to take up the bill this year, but may look into it further in future years. Kaufman said he still is interested in getting the cancer coverage bill to move in the Senate, but he said the latest bill was broader and another way to get something done to improve public service benefits. He did not rule out amending the bill to include cancer benefits. And on to today's obituaries. Evelyn Mather Edeburn Engledo was of rural Vinton. Evelyn Lucille Edeburn Engledow Mather of rural Vinton passed away peacefully on March 19th at her home, just days following her 101st birthday. Evelyn was born March 15th, 1923. Samuel Hendricks Ray Mather and Evelyn were joined in marriage on August 1st, 1949, after Evelyn's first husband, Raymond Engledow, passed away while serving in World War II. Evelyn was an active member of the Seventh-day Adventist Church and many of their volunteer programs. She loved knitting, crocheting, mushroom hunting, fishing, writing, and working in her flower bed. A celebration of life will be held at a later date. Cynthia Ray Cindy Danke, 72, passed away March 27th at her home. A celebration of Cindy's life will be from 3 to 6 p.m. Thursday, April 4th, at Lensing's Oak Hill in Coralville, with a time of sharing at 5:30 p.m. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to Suncoast Humane Society in Englewood, Florida. Born on June 20th, 1951 in Charles City, Cindy married Robert Bob Danke on February 10th, 1968 in Iowa City. Cindy had a fulfilling career as a registered nurse. For 35 years, she devoted herself to caring for patients at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics and Mercy Hospital. Lois Gladson, 92, of Marion, passed away peacefully on Thursday, March 28th. A visitation will be held on Wednesday, April 3rd at Hope United Church of Christ in Hiawatha, beginning at 9 a.m. until the time of the service at 11 a.m. Interment will follow at 4:30 p.m. at Warren County Memorial Park in Monmouth, Illinois. Lois was born on November 27, 1931, at the family farm outside Seton, Illinois. She was united into marriage to Richard Gladson on September 12, 1953. They shared 62 years together before Dick preceded her in death. Through their lives, Lois and Dick lived in Alita, Illinois, Hiawatha, Dubuque, Cedar Falls, and Cedar Rapids when they moved in 2006 to be closer to the family. Remembering Lois, in lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to Hope United Church of Christ, where Dick and Lois were founding members, or the David Gladson Scholarship Fund, directed at enhancing the study of neurological disorders at Iowa State University. George Henry Lehrer died peacefully in his sleep at home on March 27th. George was born on April 29th, 1941, in the Chicago area. He was married to the love of his life, Maureen, on September 30th of 1961 for 57 years of marriage. He worked at Cherry Burrell for 38 years, and then after retirement, worked at College Community School District for 10 years. Services are set for 1 p.m. Tuesday, April 2nd, at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. Robert G. Bob Shanka, 94, of Independence, died on Friday, February 16th, at Prairie Hills Assisted Living Center in Independence. Bob was born on December 30, 1929, in Independence, Iowa. He attended St. John's Catholic School and worked for the Carl Nichols Chrysler dealership in Independence while in high school. Bob left school early to join the United States Army. He served during the occupation of Japan after World War II and learned everything about truck driving there. He returned to Independence after his time in the service and started working as a mechanic at Burkert Ford in Independence and drove a truck for Warren Collins, Western Transport, and later in life, Merchant Freight. On July 8, 1951, Bob married Marilyn Bradley at the Fairbank United Methodist Church. They made their home in Independence. Bob retired from working as a mechanic and in 1983 went to work as a custodian and electrician at the Independence Community Schools. A memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. on Saturday, March 30th at the Reef Family Center, Funeral Home and Crematory in Independence. Visitation will be held for 2 hours prior to the service on Saturday. Ronald Eugene Knight, 82, of Cedar Rapids, died Wednesday, March 27th. A funeral service will take place at 2 p.m. on Monday, April 1st, at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids, with a visitation 1 hour prior. Burial will be in Linwood Cemetery of Cedar Rapids. Ron was born October 14, 1941, in Cedar Rapids. He was united in marriage to Esther Klein on October 15, 1977, in Vinton, Iowa. Ron worked for Amana Refrigeration for over 30 years. Joanne June Schrage, age 90, passed away peacefully on Monday, March 25, at Virginia Gay Hospital with her family by her side. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. Tuesday, April 2nd at Trinity Lutheran Church in Vinton. Visitation will be held from 9 a.m. until service time at the church. Private family interment will be held at the Iowa Veterans Cemetery in Adel. And on to some sports news. Iowa women's basketball star guard Caitlin Clark has earned a spot on the training camp roster for the U.S. Women's National Team, USA Basketball announced Thursday in a news release. The camp is another step in deciding on a roster for the 2024 Olympic Games in Paris. Clark is the only current college player to be named to the 14-player roster, joining the likes of WNBA stars such as Diana Taurasi, Kelsey Plum, Brittany Griner, Sabrina Ionescu, and others. The training camp will be April 3rd through 5th in Cleveland. Clark's attendance is a contingent on Iowa's progression through the NCAA tournament, according to the USA Basketball news release. Hawkeye fans following the Iowa women's basketball team to Albany, New York for the NCAA tournament are encouraged to attend the Hawkeye Huddle before the team's Sweet 16 game. The event is Saturday from 10:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time at Albany Stadium Restaurant and Bar, 51 South Pearl Street. The Hawkeyes face Colorado at 3:30 p.m. Eastern Time, which is 2:30 at Iowa time, at MVP Arena in Albany. Iowa State wrestling coach Kevin Dresser announced that Iowa Prep state champion Tucker Stengel of Osage will join the Cyclone program. Stengel was a two-time state champion and four-time place winner who was named the 2024 Dan Gable Class 2A Mr. Wrestler of the Year after a 54-0 senior season. He is projected as a 157-pounder. Northern Iowa's Parker Kekeson was named the 2024 Big 12 Conference's Wrestler of the Year, as announced by the league office on Thursday. Kekeson, who won the NCAA 184-pound national championship last weekend, joins assistant coach Drew Foster as the only two UNI wrestlers to receive the honor since the Panthers joined the Big 12 in the 2017-18 season. The 2024 auto racing season is set to get underway at the Cedar County Raceway, the quarter-mile dirt track located on the Cedar County Fairgrounds on the west edge of Tipton. Will see the first green flag of the season on April 5th. Hot laps begin 6 p.m. with racing to follow. Racing also will be held on April 6th, starting at 5:30 p.m. And looking at football, any talk about the Iowa football depth chart, especially as early as March, comes with a disclaimer. Take it from Coach Kirk Ferentz himself. It's March 26th right now, so it doesn't mean a lot. And I told the players that in the first meeting, Ferentz said of the depth chart during Tuesday's news conference. That being said, here are some notes from Iowa's spring depth chart and roster. Iowa offensive lineman Griffin Little is taking a medical redshirt and is no longer on the Hawkeyes roster. Iowa Sports Information confirmed. Little, a former three-star recruit in the 2021 class, did not see any game action in his 3 years on the team. This move, along with Caden Proctor's planned exit, drops Iowa's scholarship count to 90. That number needs to be down to 85 by the start of the 2024 season. Five redshirt freshmen earned spots on the offensive depth chart. Cade Piper and Trevor Lauk are second-team guards. Jarrett Bew is a second-team wide receiver. Marco Lanez is the third-team quarterback, and Rusty Van Wetsinga is the first-team fullback. Bo Stevens is listed as the starting left guard for now, but he certainly is not a lock to replace Rusty Pfeff. Ferentz mentioned Nick DeYoung and Tyler Ellsbury as other options for that position. Ellsbury is working at center in the spring while Logan Jones recovers from an injury that required surgery. Luke Gaffney, a sophomore walk-on and former Linmar standout, is one of Iowa's second-team defensive tackles. Iowa lost significant depth at the position after Logan Lee and Noah Shannon's graduation and Ontara Thompson's departure via the transfer portal. Hayden Lang has been working at fullback and tight end, Ferentz said. The walk-on transferred from NAIA Dort College in 2023 and was Iowa's first-team fullback last year. Monday's release of a spring depth chart was another reminder of the wealth of experience on the defensive side of the ball. Iowa has 8 starting seniors, graduate students, or 9 of you count, or 9 if you count Sebastian Castro and Kyler Fisher as separate starters at the Leo Cash spot on the defensive side of the ball. Tight end Gavin Hoffman, offensive lineman Josh Janowski, and punter Reese Deacon are Iowa's on-scholarship early enrollees this year. Hoffman will wear number 89, Janowski will wear number 63, and Deacon will, like his predecessor, wear number 9. Iowa coach Rick Hiller said before this college baseball season began that his Hawkeyes would be in solid shape if Cade Obermoeller was their Sunday starting pitcher. He's already been promoted from that. The sophomore southpaw from Iowa City High is scheduled to throw Iowa's Big Ten Conference game Saturday afternoon against Minnesota at Banks Field. The 3-game series begins at 4:05 p.m. today. Saturday's game is at 2:02 p.m. Sunday's afternoon's first pitch is 1:05 p.m. Obermiller threw mostly out of the bullpen last season. He made 15 appearances, 2 starts, compiling a 4.91 earned run average and striking out 36 batters in 22 innings. He was awarded a spot in the rotation to begin this season as the aforementioned third or Sunday starter behind ace Brody Brecht and Marcus Morgan. Obermiller has been good, going 1-1 with a 2.81 ERA in 6 starts. His peripherals have been really good, too, as he's holding opposing hitters to a .165 batting average, 15 hits in 28 innings. The walk totals are high at 20, but he has 35 strikeouts. Morgan has struggled early in the season, which necessitated the switch in rotation between him and Obermuller, who was named Big Ten Pitcher of the Week on March 11th after pitching into the 6th inning with a no-hitter against Jacksonville State. His stuff includes a fastball that reaches mid-90s from a sidearmish motion. Obermuller is an Iowa legacy. His father, Wes, pitched for the Hawkeyes. Wes Obermuller pitched 80 games in the major leagues for the Royals, Brewers, and Marlins. Iowa is 13-10 going into this weekend, having a non-conference game on Tuesday at Illinois State, canceled by bad weather. The Hawkeyes have won 5 of 6, including taking the final 2 games of their Big Ten opening series at Purdue. Iowa ranks 2nd in the Big Ten in team batting average and runs scored. Sam Peterson at .393, Andy Nelson at .387, and Raider Tello at .380 rank in the top dozen in the league in hitting, with 262 strikeouts in 197 and a third innings, although they are next to last in walks with 142. Iowa Athletics has retained legal counsel to conduct an independent review of the gymnastics program amid concerns about the environment of the program under head coach Larissa Libby, the department said in a news release on Thursday. Libby, in her 20th year as head coach and 24th year with the program, is on paid administrative leave to protect the integrity of the review, although it is not a disciplinary measure, according to the release. The department has tabbed Phil Contanzano, the co-founder of Boston-based Education and Sports Law Group, to conduct the review. West Virginia coach Darian DeVries brought some reinforcements from Drake. Tucker DeVries sat in the front row for his father's introductory news conference Thursday as Darian announced that his son, a 2-time Missouri Valley Conference Player of the Year, is joining him with the Mountaineers. Tucker led Drake in scoring this season at 21.6 points per game. We've identified Easter with eggs for a very long time, according to historians. Ever wonder why? Through the ages, eggs were gifted to others in the spring to celebrate the season of new growth. And if you've ever witnessed a baby chick emerging from its shell, you can see how eggs eventually became a symbol for new life celebrated by Christians at Easter. Nutritionally, eggs are considered one of the highest quality protein foods on the planet. Yet, for more than 40 years, they took a beating from health experts due to their high cholesterol content. That was when the prevailing evidence pointed to assumptions that diets high in cholesterol were bad for the heart. Then, in 2013, the American Heart Association and the American College of Cardiology unscrambled decades of research and concluded that egg consumption is not associated with cardiovascular disease or the risk of dying from heart disease in the general population. Today, there is no specific advice to limit cholesterol in our diets, and eggs are now recommended as part of a healthful diet in the most current dietary guidelines for Americans. Think about it. Within one little eggshell are all the nutrients needed to produce a new life. That includes numerous vitamins and minerals, including vitamin B12, selenium, and biotin. And don't forget choline, a not-so-easy nutrient to get in other foods. That is vital for maintaining the structure and function of every cell in the body. Choline is especially important during the development of the brain during pregnancy and young childhood. Even as we age, research has found that choline is essential to maintain memory and other brain functions. Don't assume that naturally colored brown, blue, or green shells are more nutritious, however. Egg color is determined by the breed of chicken, not nutrient content, says experts. Of course, all this good nutrition comes only when we handle raw and cooked eggs wisely. Eggs need to be refrigerated within 36 hours of being laid, says the Food and Drug Administration, and they should stay refrigerated. That's especially important once they are cooked, says the USDA Food Safety and Inspection Service. If you're cooking and dyeing Easter eggs, for example, don't leave them unrefrigerated for more than 2 hours. And of course, have your little ones wash their hands before they handle the eggs. If kiddos are hunting for real eggs, hide them off the ground and in places that are protected from dirt and other sources of bacteria, say these experts. Once the hunt is over, rinse and put them back in the fridge. Then, within a week, get cracking with these brightly colored symbols of new life. Egg salad, anyone? Be a good egg and have a very blessed Easter. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, March 29th, 2024. I'm your reader, Grace Barter. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.